It's Wednesday, December 13th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens uses a secret chat app to conduct state business and the efforts reporters have made to find out what is in those messages. We're going to talk about that. Could we be on the precipice of a Gawker comeback? Several of the site's old writers want your help to resurrect the bankrupt brand. We'll talk about that effort. And a sharp-tongued editorial from the USA Today calling President Trump unfit to hold office, let alone clean the toilets of the Obama Presidential Library or shine George W. Bush's shoes. That editorial was published last night, right about the time that the news was really coming out of Alabama, where Doug Jones pulled ahead and eked out a win against Roy Moore in the Ruby Red state.
At the end of the day, this entire race has been about dignity and respect.
That anybody expected it to be over as early as it was last night, that speech airing at about 10 o'clock our time, or for it really to end up going the way that it did.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by how quickly the race was called by some agencies, even though NBC, I think, was the last news agency to actually call it. And they came out and said Jones was an apparent winner, as opposed to saying that he was the official winner. And so they held that back. But, you know, I think it was one of those instances where at least the Secretary of State in Alabama wanted to make sure that he got it right, because he wanted to make sure that it was not going to be an election that was going to be contested on national television.
If you tuned in the middle of it, you might have been surprised to know that you were looking at a special election for senator in Alabama. The TV media had all the trappings of covering a presidential contest or something, because they had the magic wall on CNN. They had all their talking heads out there. They had the exit polls that they were, you know, previewing before the polls closed. And it seemed to me that the media had some sense that something could happen, that it was close enough that it was worth investing that kind of coverage in it.
Yeah, there was a lot of apprehension on the part of the talking heads to call it, even though they could see from the boards that the states that were still out around 9:30, 10 o'clock were heavily Democratic states, but there was still this sort of hesitancy to call it.
One of the things I noticed too is I had CNN on TV at some points, going over to MSNBC, but primarily watching CNN and refreshing the Washington Post and the New York Times the entire time. And I was kind of surprised. It almost seemed as though CNN was lagging behind the Post and the New York Times in terms of results, that at some points they were 10% and 15% of the vote count behind in terms of precincts reporting.
I noticed that a couple of times, and clearly CNN was not going to call it first. I believe actually the New York Times called it first.
Followed by the AP very soon after.
And I think CNN is still sensitive to anything that could foster the accusations that they're fake news or somehow biased against Trump. But they sure brought out the resources to, once they found out what the results were going to be, their coverage was pretty much down the line. This is going to be a loss for President Trump, and this could be a signal of what's going to happen in 2018.
Yeah, I also think it was one of those instances where the exit polls was showing one thing, and then you had people on the ground that was saying something else, and then they went back to their modeling to say, okay, if Jones is going to win, he's going to have to do these things. And once it was called, they went back to that and said, look, we said that he had to do all these things, and he did all of these things and then some, and it was still a pretty tight election.
I couldn't help but see the irony of Roy Moore campaign folks having up the New York Times on their monitors, watching the way they were tracking the over-under, basically, from the results that were coming in, given how this campaign, from his standpoint at least, was largely attacking the media and the left for trying to do him in with false accusations about sexual harassment and all that. They were still tracking the New York Times because I think they thought that probably gave them the most accurate view of what was really going on.
Review. And interestingly enough, one of the things that was reported too, he shut out the Washington Post.
Wouldn't give
them credentials, wouldn't let them in to cover any of this. Is that a sign, do you think, looking back at it, was that a sign of defiance? Was that a sign of not wanting to welcome in the people who broke the story against him originally?
I don't know what the motives were, but I will say this much. If you want to point to a single example of traditional news media having a significant impact on a large American event, here it was, because if it had not been for the Washington Post's reporting initially on Roy Moore, he would have easily glided to victory in a heavily Republican state.
Well, I mean, the other thing that I found striking last night was when Roy Moore's campaign chief campaign advisor came out right before Moore did to talk about, well, we're not going to concede the election. We think there needs to be a recount. This is a close one. And then Moore came out and gave his speech, and then they went back to the talking heads. They were like stunned, saying
the talking heads.
The talking heads.
Well, I'm not going to lie, I was stunned.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. When you watch that, they were just like, no, there's not going to be a recount. Dude, you lost.
Well, the Secretary of State pretty much came right out and said that, too, unless he's going, meaning he is in Roy Moore, is going to be the one to pay for that.
Well, and I think kudos to CNN on that, because they had a producer or a reporter embedded there with the Secretary of State, and it couldn't have been more than a minute or two after Moore's spokesperson said that they were on the air live with the Secretary of State refuting the likelihood that there would be any kind of recount, unless Roy Moore wanted to pay for it.
Right.
And if he did, it would likely not succeed.
Right.
So one of the stories, provided we have time to get to it, that's a little bit later down in our show, has to do with a court ruling this week with making a murderer and with one of the people involved in that not going to be released from prison. And there are some journalists who've been feeling, and documentarians feeling, like there was a lot of effort that went into that. There was a lot that was done to prove that perhaps maybe this guy didn't get due process. And people who felt frustrated that, like, journalism wasn't going to win, you know? Journalism didn't matter. This was, Mike, you just described the complete opposite of that. Journalism won last night.
And journalism didn't win by itself, but it planted the seeds for the kind of conversation that occurred and the kind of campaign that the Democrats were surprisingly able to mobilize in Alabama, especially bringing out heavily African-American vote, getting women to vote.
And the African-American woman vote.
I mean, frankly, that's
one headline, frankly, that has been somewhat diminished and not covered fairly
enough.
And
getting Republicans in significant numbers, 1.5% or something, 20-some thousand people to write in somebody other than Roy Moore or Doug Jones.
I think the coverage that... The coverage of the media, especially this past weekend, where they were on the ground in Alabama talking to people who were likely voters to get a sense as to what they were going to do, informed them of the way in which they should cover the election on election night. And I think that work really played out last night.
That was one of those cases where the journalists made it about the people they were covering and not about themselves.
Yep.
It's interesting because as I was watching CNN, and one of the questions that was asked of the talking heads is, so how does President Trump respond to this on Twitter? And this is before Jones even has an opportunity to get to the podium and to offer his acceptance speech. And one of the things that was said at that point in that speculation was that it was not so likely that he was going to do that, because that was the moment we first learned of a very sharply worded editorial in the USA Today, a publication that we should note isn't normally known for its opinion section. In it, reaction to the president's tweet about Senator Kirsten Gillibrand saying she would do anything for a campaign contribution.
I see it as a sexist smear. I mean, that's what it is. And part of the president's effort at name calling, and it's not going to silence me.
Most other people saw it that way too, except, well, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Gillibrand owed an apology for the misunderstanding from the president's tweet this morning, because many, including the senator, thinks that it's about sexual innuendos.
I think only if your mind is in the gutter would you have read it that way. And so no, Hunter.
No, it's not. What he said was open, and it was not mind in the
gutter. Obviously talking about political partisan games that people often play, and the broken system that he's talked about repeatedly. This isn't new. This isn't a new sentiment. This isn't new terminology. He's used it several times before. As I said a few minutes ago, he's used it several times before, referencing men of both parties, in fact. And so I think that there, if you look back at the past comments he's made, it was very clear what his reference was.
The editorial board at the USA Today had a good sense of what it believed his reference was, writing that a president who would all but call Senator Kirsten Gillibrand a whore is not fit to clean the toilets in the Barack Obama Presidential Library or to shine the shoes of George W. Bush. It goes on to say in that editorial that this is well beyond the idea of ideological differences, that Trump has failed both of his predecessors in multiple ways, that yeah, they broke campaign promises. Yeah, they had failed initiatives, but their decency as human beings was never put in doubt.
Well, so without reacting to the actual content of the editorial, I mean, people can draw their own conclusions about this. I'm kind of interested in why USA Today finally decided to put out an editorial like this. As you mentioned, they're not known for taking striking editorial positions, but why now? Now, at first, I was really cynical about it because, as you mentioned, it was first referenced on TV after the results clearly showed that Doug Jones was going to win. So, okay, that doesn't show much courage to put out that kind of editorial after you know how this election is coming down. But in fact, I checked, and it was actually submitted about a half hour before the polls closed. So I don't think USA Today had any special knowledge about the direction it was going, but I still wonder why now? Because clearly there have been many, many examples. They cited several of them in the editorial that could have caused them to write the same thing weeks or months ago.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, think about all the comments that the president has made about Elizabeth Warren over the course of the last month. And that didn't get the reaction that this did. I wonder if it's one of those things where with everything that's going on in Congress and everything that's going on within entertainment and news and even in the news media, mm-hmm. about sexual misconduct and how that has changed over the course of, say, the last couple of months, that USA Today said, wait a minute, you know, we cannot go along with the President of the United States attacking a sitting U.S. senator in this kind of a fashion and not say something.
And continuing to do so even as the atmosphere has changed.
Right.
This isn't about a
right.
past action. This is something yeah. that literally happened yesterday.
Right.
I mean, and if you look at the actual tweet, is it possible to spin it the way that Sarah Sanders did? It's possible to do that if you were taking that tweet in isolation with no other context around it. Because, I mean, he didn't literally call her a whore or say she would give sexual favors for campaign contributions. But if you see it in the context of everything else he has said and done on Twitter, the way he has treated women who have accused him of wrongdoing or just been on the separate side of him on some political issue, this fits in. The pattern is too obvious.
And I think that's where USA Today and others are going. I mean, if you've been watching any of the news outlets since yesterday mm-hmm. about this, they are all pretty much on the same page, with the exception of some of the shows on Fox. They're all on the same page and saying this kind of reaction on the part of the president is just reprehensible.
Well, it was somewhat interesting this morning on the Today Show. Kirsten Gillibrand appeared on the Today Show and Savannah Guthrie was interviewing her and tried to present the devil's advocate side. So Mike, as you're saying, is there a way for Sarah Huckabee Sanders to spin this? And one of the things she said was, well, would you consider that when the president said the same thing about Mitt Romney a year ago and said he asked for those same favors and would have almost gotten down on his knees, was that sexual innuendo in the same way? And you could almost see the senator roll her eyes at Savannah Guthrie and trying to put that question to her that way.
I mean, I just, you know, I don't think there's any way, in light of what you just said, Mike, when you look at it in context over the course of not just his political career, but even going back to his entertainment career, this is the type of behavior. And so it's kind of hard to say that he was saying it in a different way when this is the way he's always done it.
And if you focus on Sarah Sanders and not on the president for a second, she also has limited credibility when she makes this kind of spin because of some of this outrageous things she's said over the past several months that have been clearly false.
Yeah.
Some of them, I think there's one publication that's tracking and that it's in the thousands, something like 1,300 statements that have been outright false. And while we're talking about false and perhaps those claims again and again about fake news, imagine going to jail for spreading fake news. Lawmakers in Ireland took a hard look at the role of social media in the spreading of fake news through bots in 2016 in our election and during the Brexit vote the summer previous. And it's introduced some legislation that could send people to, that run those bots to prison for up to 5 years. The hope is to stop some of this spread of deceptive material before it has a chance to actually get out there. They say it's loosely based on legislation in our House of Representatives.
Well, it is to the extent that they also put forward new regulations requiring you to be transparent about the source of funding for advertising, to show where it's coming from. That models some of the legislation that's still in Congress, hasn't been passed. But then they add on this extra layer of criminalizing using bots, which is the technique that a lot of the, sort of the right-wing fake news machines use to reach as many people.
And also the Russians.
But, I mean, I don't know how you can criminalize, you know, a particular technology divorced from the content. If you can't evaluate what the content is and say it is somehow fake and injurious to the political process, I don't know how you penalize somebody.
You know, I think this is one of those instances where the legal profession is far behind where technology is, and they're trying to figure out some sort of way to legislate technology while technology is moving at a faster rate. There's going to be a difficulty, going back to what Mike was saying, difficulty there. But the other issue with this is, are you blaming them for the public not being smart enough to see that the information is fake? This goes back to the media literacy and news literacy thing that we talk about over and over again. So it's sort of this, well, we can't, since we need to protect the public, but sometimes the public needs to figure out a way to protect themselves.
It's like I tell my reporting students, we're only as good as journalists as the people we're covering are stupid, right? So these bots and these people spreading the fake information, again, only as good as the people who are consuming the fake information are for not being critical of what they're consuming. Let's shift gears and let's talk about some things going on here in our own state. Jason Hancock's story in the Kansas City Star Thursday revealed that Governor Eric Greitens has been using an encrypted chat app called Confide to communicate with top staffers. This app, it's ephemeral. It has messages that self-destruct as soon as they're read. And if you try to take a screenshot of them, you're kicked out of the message and a notification is sent to the sender. This really, it's only a problem if you're conducting state business that should be done transparently because it's a business of the people.
And how do we know? Because by the nature of the app, not only does it self-destruct, and as you say, you can't take a screenshot, you can't even share it. But there's no way to have a record. And the whole point of conducting public business in public is that there's some sort of record that we can go back to after the fact and see if there's any wrongdoing there. And so there's no record. We can't say that the governor and his staff are conducting public business with these apps, but you have to wonder, why do they have them on their cell phones if they're not?
Well, then I think therein lies the problem. What is the reason for having this on your phone and using it with people who are working for you,
trying to hide content or discussions?
Exactly. And to me, that's where the problem comes into play. But then again, you have to remember that Greitens came in to office saying that he was going to be more transparent than his predecessors. And now we've come to find out that in his zeal to try to show his transparency and that he's getting things done, we find out he's not being as transparent as he should be, or he has a different definition of transparency. I don't know.
So first of all, let me say this is a classic example, just like the Washington Post reporting, you know, on Ramoy, the classic example of why we need mainstream traditional news organizations to cover state government. And we've talked for years on this show about how news organizations are cutting back. If the Kansas City Star hadn't been chasing this story, we wouldn't have known about it. And then when you find out the reaction to it from the governor's office, it was highly legalistic. I mean, you know, it was, well, they didn't have it on any state-issued devices. So what? Mm-hmm. If they're using private devices to
And you're a state,
state
official. You're, right. you're an elected government official.
And then when Josh Hawley, the attorney general, was right. asked about it, he says, I'm not going to investigate it because, well, the law won't allow me. There's a conflict of interest because I represent the governor and state agencies and other business.
But at the same time, Tessa Weinberg, who is one of the state government reporters for the Missourian, and I will say she's also a student who was assigned to me as a mentor. So while we're talking about transparency, Tessa and I know each other very well. And she did some reporting, too, though, that in the state of Illinois, Attorney General Lisa Madigan has gotten around that and has almost created kind of an office that's entire purpose is to eliminate that conflict of interest and still serve the people when the Attorney General itself can't investigate the office.
And in fact, a while back, the Attorney General of Missouri, who was most recently our governor, ran into that same situation. He appointed a special investigator to look into it. So there are ways to do it.
Yeah, and this is that's one of the things that lawmakers are calling for now. Democratic mm-hmm. lawmakers are basically saying, look, you know, we need to have a special investigator brought in to take a look at not just this issue, but other issues involving transparency on the part of the governor's office.
Tessa had another interesting story. Tessa's been on a roll with the governor this week. Tessa had another interesting story that looked at and profiled some of the people who he has blocked on social media, which raises another interesting point, that idea of should an elected official have the ability to cut off communication with a constituent simply because they don't like the communication that's being shared on social media?
And so much of this has to do with what are these public officials using their, quote, private, unquote, social media accounts for? If Governor Greitens had a private Facebook or Twitter account and he wanted to block people when he was having conversations with friends or family or whatever, fine. But when he's using Facebook to do Facebook Live events as governor, when he's engaging with people who agree with him on his Facebook page about public policy, then blocking them or keeping them from asking questions through social media is the same kind of violation of the ability for the public to be a part of the conversation.
I don't like it when he cuts off reporters or when Trump, whatever, denies access to a reporter. It's something different when it's a constituent, though. I was having coffee with a KBIA colleague earlier this week, and we started talking about what everyone else has been talking about, the sexual misconduct reckoning. That's what she called it, and it seemed rather apropos. Ironically enough, as soon as I got back to my computer from that meeting, I saw that The New Yorker had cut ties with one of its rock star reporters, Ryan Lizza, over a relationship that he had had with a woman. Lizza's statement following that was one of complete shock, saying that his accuser and he had had a respectful relationship and that The New Yorker couldn't or wouldn't point to any company policy that had been violated.
Yeah, I think this is one of the instances where the accusation, mm-hmm. basically they made a decision that they were going to let him go based on the accusation before doing the investigation. And I was reading a story just the other day mm-hmm. that talked that HR agencies, HR departments. Operations and departments within these companies are having a really hard time trying to figure out how do we deal with this in real time. And now all of a sudden you're having these HR specialists who are literally sitting in on these meetings trying to go like, whoa, wait a minute, we need to make sure that there's due process before we announce these things.
And MSNBC actually hired back a contributor that it had fired based on a salacious tweet about Roman Polanski from years ago saying, hey, maybe we moved too fast and we messed this one up.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Lizza, first of all, to me, is that one person accused him and there has not been an investigation yet. Now, the lawyer for the accuser says it wasn't, you know, a consensual relationship or what occurred there was not, you know, how it was characterized by Lizza. We don't know,
right.
But this is the first instance of one of these prominent journalists or media figures going down on the accusations of one person who hasn't come forward and hasn't been corroborated by anybody else.
I mean, one of the things I will say is that in all the other instances, there was a pattern, and there had already been investigations, there had already been payouts mm-hmm. in certain cases. So in those, I think they handled it the way it should have been handled. But in instances that we aren't hearing about because these people aren't famous, the story I was reading is basically saying that HR people are really having a difficult time trying to deal with this.
And when you were starting to bring up the Sam Sater case yeah. from MSNBC, a totally different situation. This was a tweet. There was no allegation of misbehavior, right? It was a tweet that he had written in the context of criticizing French government officials who were trying to make excuses for Roman Polanski after he'd been convicted of having forced sex with a teenager back in his days as a director in the United States. It was not a well-crafted tweet in an age when you're kind of making fun of rape to make a point about Roman Polanski, right. But it wasn't about behavior. And clearly this whole thing was puffed up by, some right-wing folks who wanted to bring down a news figure. And once MSNBC figured out that, well, maybe their reaction was a little hair trigger because of the other things they've been accused of at that network, they were right to bring him back.
Yes, they were. And that's what I'm wondering is how many of these may end up being a little hair trigger where we may start seeing other people coming back too. Last year, when Univision bought Gawker Media out of bankruptcy, the deal didn't include Gawker itself, the brand's flagship website, the one found responsible in the Hulk Hogan defamation case. Well, it looks like we might not have seen the end of Gawker. On Monday, a handful of former employees started a Kickstarter campaign to raise $500,000 to make a run for it. Some of the folks who are behind this are saying that, yeah, some of them do have jobs right now, that they'd be willing to leave them to go back and to buy out Gawker. Do we need it back? It was one of those that at the time was brave enough to tell some of these stories about Louis C.K., about about Harvey Weinstein, some of these other names that we've been seeing. But maybe we don't need it yourself.
I'm not sure we need it. I mean, yeah. the people who want to start it maybe feel like there's a need there. But there are other news organizations, both startup as well as legacy, that have filled the void there that Gawker may have been out front in doing these kinds of stories. But I think now that there are other news organizations that are out there doing it, it's a much different climate now in terms of news gathering than it was then. So I'm not sure whether this is necessary.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut the discussion short, but I'm seeing we only have about a minute and a half left. And before we go, I do want to take at least a second or two to remember two journalists who died on Sunday. Simeon Booker risked his life in the 50s and 60s covering the early days of the civil rights movement for Ebony and Jet magazines, and was also the first Black reporter hired at the Washington Post. And we also lost Roy Reed, who had deep connections to the University of Missouri and the School of Journalism and was at the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Bloody Sunday covering that for the New York Times. We have about 30 seconds or so. So something to say about the legacy of these two men.
Well, I think that though they were at the beginning of what we would today call the social justice movement, and they covered it and risked their lives in doing so. And I think that there are those within journalism who owe a debt to them that they continue to do that type of reporting.
Well, we are pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today and that Making a Murderer one we didn't quite have time for. They're all on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. We're going to be taking a few weeks off for the holidays and be back with you on January 10th for another edition and another year of Views of the News.